My name is Kirsty, and I am the host of the Mindset and Me podcast. Formerly, I'm an accredited transformational and mindset coach, Vedic meditation teacher, and wellness expert. I'm obsessed with helping you navigate the messy middle and find clarity in every season of life. Informally, I'm a pale rosé wine lover, chocoholic, and your new bestie. We get into all the life lessons and learnings from the most incredible guests to help you gain clarity and get into an abundant mindset. So go and grab a coffee, get cozy, get comfortable. This is the Mindset and Me podcast. Welcome back to the Mindset and Me podcast. I am so excited and honored to bring this guest forth for you this week. You may have, we're going back quite a few months now, remembered when I shared on my Instagram stories about interviewing the woman who wrote the book on anxious attachment style. I'm honored to be sharing this episode with Jessica Balm. She is one of the most incredible and intelligent women I've ever interviewed. The way that she talks, the way that she explains everything will have you hooked. I honestly could have stayed in the conversation for hours. She is a licensed psychotherapist and mental health counselor, as well as relationship expert, featured in the likes of InStyle, Mind Body Green, The Huffington Post, Brides, just to mention a few. Jessica wrote the book Anxiously Attached, and I am honored to bring her to the podcast this week. The podcast, Jessica, how are you today?
I'm good. I had a late morning, so I'm happy to be here and happy to be having this conversation. Oh,
well, thank you. I was just saying before we started recording, I've been looking forward to this all week. We're recording on a Friday and we have a slight time difference, but we're here and I've just been looking forward to it so much. I'm such a huge fan of yours and your message and all your work you do. So before we get into that, I just want to say thank you for the work that you do. I found you on podcasts, on YouTube videos. I have your book. It's just incredible and it's really important work.
Thank you so much. I'm so happy it's getting out there in the world and it's really touching people and making an impact.
Yeah, absolutely. So I guess it's always really good to start for anyone who's not familiar with attachment theory. How would you best describe that for someone to really understand if this is just totally brand new to them?
Yeah, so attachment theory has actually been around since the 1950s, but it's very well researched and there's a lot of science behind it. And it's basically, you know, how we attach to our primary caregiver forms embedded patterns inside our body and our nervous system. And there are several different types of attachment styles. Think of them as, I don't like to think of them as labels, but like you can fit into a category. And there's secure, anxious, avoidant, and then there's like a disorganized or fearful, avoidant kind of attachment style. So they're embedded patterns in our nervous system, and how we embed these patterns and how we relate to another determines our sense of safety in connection and what we do when we're scared and our ability to form strong, intimate relationships. And all of that is kind of combined into our attachment styles and explains a lot of why we might have a lot of struggles as well. That's why I think so many people like learning about it. And it's an embedded pattern and it's a combination of two people's embedded patterns. So you might show up one way. And when you partner with someone, as the relationship unfolds later down the road, their embedded strategies and your embedded strategies become the relational dance. And that's why it's not as simple as just your style, but your style changes depending on who you're also partnering.
It's really interesting. Is it right that it's like 56% of people are securely attached or around there?
Yeah, I think a lot more people are moving towards insecure attachment styles based on so many reasons in our culture and the way, you know, children are getting raised and the amount of anxiety in the world. And it's moving, unfortunately, in an insecure direction.
Definitely. One thing that really stood out for me when I was reading your book, stood out for me and also terrified me in a way, was when you were talking about the ANS. And how when someone is pregnant, it can actually be like three months into the pregnancy, we mirror our mothers, we develop this feeling already. And that for me, if I'm ever blessed enough to be a mother, was terrifying in a way that we can really imprint before our children are even born.
Yeah, actually in womb. And that's, so there's cellular memory, there's epigenetics, there's a lot of things that we pass down. But when we're in womb, if our mother is having trauma or crisis, there's cellular memory that's already starting to impact the fetus. And actually, womb to four, I would say, impact us more than we even know it in terms of attachment styles and how we show up in the world. And so because we're not born with a left hemisphere fully developed, we're born in, as sensing beings, and we're one energetic unit with our mother, her nervous system, her experience, our way of developing our brain is all mirroring hers. And so she's in what we call fight, flight, or survival mode, or depressed, or going through a lot. The baby is absorbing that because we can't tell the difference between ourselves and another at that state. So we're taking in a lot, and it's no one's fault. I mean, moms are literally doing the best that we can, you know, that they can. But yeah, I think if you're highly stressed or you have a lot of trauma that's unresolved, that's how intergenerational trauma gets passed down unconsciously and out of your awareness.
Thank you. Yeah, for sharing that it's unconsciously as well, because I think that's so important. And to say no one's doing anything wrong at that stage, you know, it's just we're all literally all trying our best, aren't we, in those situations. There was a part of the ANS as well that you talked about, which again, like you, I honestly have to say you've taught me so much. So I can't wait for everyone to listen to this podcast. But when you looked at three different branches of the nervous system, and like the ventral and the sympathetic and the dorsal, and I have a lot of people who are super interested in how the brain works, how the body works. That's kind of the whole premise of the podcast. And so if you could go into that in a little bit more detail, it's super interesting, because I think it gives like the backbone for like the theories and how it might be showing up for people to kind of understand their behavior.
Yeah, no, it's so interesting. So Dr. Stephen Porges is where I've gotten some of that work, and he's like a pioneer in our field, and he talks about the vagus nerve. And so basically what we've learned in the process of human development is, or evolution, is that we have in our highest evolution something called our social engagement system. And so that's up here in our face. That's your ability and my ability to sense safety and exchange and be in a sense of safety and expansion and curiosity and fluid in our body and with each other. And so we can be in that state. And some people even think it's a state of grace when we're really in that state. But that's our highest evolution and where we would like to be most of the day. But as you shift down in there in the middle of our body, there's something around sympathetic activation. So there's like fight flight responses. So this is a part of our system that was designed so that if we're a bear is chasing us or something is coming at us, our neuroception or our sense of danger gets alerted and we can make a fast response. We can fight or we can flee, and that's an automatic response, right? And then there's dorsal, which is lower and in our gut. And this is even more reptilian and an older way of surviving. And you can think of this as someone who freezes. Like let's say a rape victim, and you go dissociate, you freeze, you shut down, you go into fetal position. Now, all of these ways of being are there for our own, to protect us. The problem is, as we were babies and as we're like kind of sensing the world, we learn what's danger and what's not danger. So we're biologically wired to stay in connection. And if anything is threatening, now, and threatening could be different for me and you, we could shift out of our ventral state and into these other states of being. And it's very, very scary. It's quite brilliant that our body's always trying to protect us. Unfortunately, an email can feel shift us, or a roll of our partner's eyes, or our partner being intoxicated, or these things can all shift us based on our history and take us out of a state of ease and into a state of fight, flight, freeze, fawn, all those states very easily. So I think, you know, understanding your nervous system responses is not about being in the perfect state. We can't do that. This is automatic, but it's about understanding, wow, some part of me, and I use little me, but some part of me is activated right now, or some part of me is terrified right now, or this is what's going on for me and I don't understand it. And now we can start to make sense of it, meet it where it's at, and not be totally freaked out or reactive around it. And it's hard to not react when you're in fight flight. I mean, literally, you're trying to run for your life.
Yeah, you've explained that so beautifully. Thank you so much. So On that subject, and you mentioned about partners and how something so small can trigger you, and I've definitely been there in past relationships. How important is it, do you think, for you to understand your own attachment style, but plus your partner's, or if you live with roommates or whoever, like whatever your situation, to kind of understand? Because I think in the world now, maybe there's a lot of conversation about how we need to present ourselves and how we are, but actually it's really important to understand that other person, to have compassion for their style as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's like the golden formula in a lot of ways, because I think not just their style. I mean, and I give people quizzes. There's a quiz on my website, but understanding, how do you react in fear? How do you react in conflict? Do you need space? Do you need time? Do you get anxious? Do you need reassurance? Do you like communication? What communication can we put into place now? Because conflict, which was what we call rupture, is going to happen. That's part of a healthy dynamic in every relationship. And so understanding your partner's attachment style and what they do in conflict and how to best support them. And most importantly, and I talk about this in the book a lot, is that anxious and avoidant, the way in which each person stays safe actually perpetuates a sense of feeling of danger for the other. So an anxious person expands their energy and they want connection and they want to get closer, and fight is usually right there. And an avoidant person can shut down their energy and need time and space. And so it can be two people in fear cycles constantly activating each other through nervous systems and not really understanding that their systems are signaling fear when they're trying to get out of this. So just understanding it alone starts to bring a level of awareness and compassion that my partner's not actually trying to hurt me. They're very, very scared right now. So I think knowing that with your partner and knowing that and with your roommates and having these conversations, and less about what attachment style, but more about like, how can we resolve conflict maybe based on your attachment style, or knowing that about yourself, you'll be able to answer that question a little bit easier. And, you know, knowing if you need space and asking and having those communication skills or conversations before conflict arises, or to see if you'd even be a good match, basically.
Do you have any like specific examples where you've seen people doing that? Because I really do think actually there is something in that. And I've definitely been in that situation with an anxious and avoidant, which you reflect back on. But at the time, I had no idea, no concept of it. And actually, it was fear driven. And I had that feeling in my belly, like that really unhealthy, gut-wrenching feeling. And I didn't have the tools, and I didn't really know what I would do in that situation. So I guess if you have like any specific examples or just ways that even people can approach that, because it can feel, I guess if you're anxious, can feel really scary to even approach that conversation.
Yeah, well, I think approaching it is important, but I think the biggest piece of advice I would give you, because probably so many of your listeners can identify that, and not every avoidant person wants to go to therapy, but couples counseling would be huge. But my like caveat to that is, if you are experiencing extreme sensations in your body, they are implicit memories. Your partner's actually not doing that to you. They're bringing that up inside of you. And if you can bring that to a real professional to hold, you can actually heal it to the point where your partner can't activate it as much anymore. So you can heal it with your partner if they're willing to do the work with you. And you can absolutely heal it no matter what on your own if you bring those sensational experiences to someone to hold them. That's how we integrate embedded trauma. So there's an empowering feeling. It's horrible to go through that. And I went through that, and a lot of people can identify how miserable being stuck in an anxious avoidance cycle is. But there is a path out, whether your partner wants to do it with you or not, through taking those embedded traumas, because that's really what you're feeling in your gut. Your partner's bringing that up. And so we get stuck in projecting, trying to control, and we've all done it, myself included. And I think if you can say, okay, my God, this is actually trauma being activated. My partner's not trying to activate this. Are they willing to get help with me? Because chances are they're in a fear state too. And if they're not, who can I bring this to that actually can help me incorporate this, get this trauma in my system, link it, integrate it in my brain so that I don't have to live in this fear all the time.
It's really powerful. It's incredible advice. Thank you so much. So I guess if you're working on healing your trauma and you're working with a professional, how easy is it to change the style, but not to change it, but to stay in it, to not be able to have somebody bring up those feelings again or feel triggered by something again? Because I actually like have talked about it before. I used to be very anxious, and I would safely say now I'm not, but I would say it's constant work to not get into that space again, that I've been there when it was gut-wrenching. I lost so much weight. There was just so many things. And, you know, I've worked with therapists, I work with coaches and mentors, and I meditate and do all these things proactively. But there is a tiny part of me that always has the fear that I might go back to that.
Well, I mean, and the truth is that it's a well-worn path in your brain. So, you know, you've developed other pathways and you've expanded your neuroplasticity and you have more resources now. And on a really bad day, you know, you're going to take that pathway. And so there's nothing wrong with that. And when you say triggered, I really like to shift to the word awakened.
I love that.
Because the truth is, it's not about avoiding our triggers. It's about when we're being awakened inside. Mm-hmm. We want to be with those parts in the presence of someone who can help us integrate them. Because if we just go around avoiding what is scary, we're not really healing. We're just avoiding people, places, and things in our life. But if we take what's being awakened inside of us to someone who can help connect the dots, hold the sensational experience, we no longer need to avoid that experience, because the experience eventually loses its charge and it gets integrated. So yeah, a lot of people are like, oh, I'll just change the person, place, or thing. Yeah. And I'm not saying that sometimes that's definitely needed. If you're getting dysregulated every day in an environment and you can't stay regulated, taking yourself out of that environment is important. And bringing those experiences to someone else's nervous system, because it's all about nervous systems, who can hold the uncomfortable sensations with you, because those uncomfortable sensations that you're having are actually primal. They're coming from a really young age and you didn't get the holding that you needed. So now we have to re-experience that in the presence of someone else's nervous system, and that's actually how you heal the trauma. And so can you heal it? Yeah, and I think when you talk about neuroplasticity, I can say, you know, let's say you live across the street from me and it's snowing out and anxiety is the path I shovel from my house to your house. That's a well-worn path. But as you start to heal, we call our window of tolerance expands. And I talk about the selfful state expanding in the book. And we form other ways to get to each other's houses. But if it's a really bad day, I might travel down that path of anxiety. And so it takes the brain is always changing, but because we've wired this way so long, it takes a long way to start to create these other pathways and then time to start to take them. So it changes possible, and that pathway of anxiety is always going to be there as well. It's actually trying to protect you, and that's the way you kind of need to look at it.
It's always quite nice to feel something, I think, sometimes as well, to feel those emotions, because I guess if you dull one, you dull all of them. So to feel that in some way shows me I'm aware of this. Maybe I don't want to be in this situation right now, but I know that I'm aware of it and I'm in it, and there are things that I can do to change it.
Right. Yeah. And that's little me, right? She's there. She's scared. And it's like, oh, thank you for showing yourself. Can I handle this? Or can I bring my little me to someone to help hold her? Because that's how we grow her up. And what we're doing is we're growing up the infant parts and the really, really early sensational experiences, because we have memory when we're that young that is different than what most people think is memory. So if it's in your gut like that, it's really, really early.
It's just so interesting. And I had actually, I mentioned that I was interviewing somebody and I had so many questions around how to become more secure in relationships. And people feel that being in a relationship in a city has affected them and is totally different to what they've seen. So I live in London and I'm not from London. Like many people, we all move when we're young and we want to experience everything. But there's become this toxic way of dating and this toxic way of having relationships. And it's obviously not like solely in London, but people have spoke to me about feeling incredibly insecure and not having this before. And so I'm really curious to know, I guess, like what is even step one of starting to become more secure in a relationship?
Well, I think that I could speak to that on so many levels. We're just, people aren't aware of the stages of relationships. Yeah. And so, you know, there's wounds that are going to come up in every relationship, and there's conflict, there's rupture and repair. Relationships are about being conscious of our own wounding and how that plays out in that dynamic. And we live in a very transactional culture where you go online and you date someone, and if it's not good, you discard them, and you go online and you date someone. And you start to realize there are better fits than not, but usually people are jumping ship when the actual mm-hmm. work shows up. And it's really, really easy to just kind of just be more transactional and give up without the insight of, wow, what's coming up for me? Is this really about this person? Is there some work to do here? Could I create some insight here? And I just think people are getting ghosted. And it's just, it's so common in our culture to be like, get rid of the person.
Yes.
This isn't working. And sometimes it's not working when you have two people who really can't do the work, but often that is the work. When it's not working, is getting help around really deeply understanding why, because that's where your own personal growth is.
It's really interesting. I guess when you've been in that situation before, you mentioned, and I've obviously read in your book, but we don't have to go into too much detail, but you were in a very anxious and avoidant relationship. And so to come out of that and kind of do this work, how do you step into something and not be fearful of that situation again? Because I personally have found that difficult. And for me, it's a work in progress, but I'm just curious to know.
Well, I mean, if you do the work, you're less likely. If you do the work in a relationship that is bringing mm-hmm. up the work, you're less likely to have such an extreme reaction next yeah. time, because you're becoming more secure in a harder relationship. And when you build more security, you're building more resourcing, and you're less likely. So in Imago Theory, which is the type of couples counseling that I do, you attract people who are wounded developmentally at the same space, not exactly mm-hmm. the same. They can be a little up and a little bit down. But if you do the work while you're in that relationship, really do the work, you're likely to come out and attract someone whose wounding is a little bit more and more. And that's why you see people repeating the same yeah. patterns over and over and over again, because they never really do mm-hmm. the inner work. And so then, you know, and sometimes the patterns are 5 years later, here they are again, you know. But if you do the work while you're in any relationship, whether with that partner or alone, there's a very good chance when you leave that relationship, if you do leave that relationship, you might attract someone who's developmentally wounded at the yeah. next stage. And there's the further up the wounding, the easier it is, because the less implicit the memories yeah. are. So what I mean by that, if there's a primal wound that's happening in the relationship, it's very hard to make sense of that, because that memory mm-hmm. there is very not as easy to mm-hmm. grasp. But if there's a developmental room at 4 or 6 or 8, it becomes easier to make sense of, oh, that this is where the origin of my behavior is really stemming from. Mm-hmm. So as you heal these really primal sensations, really heal them, you're less likely to be attracted to someone at that stage. I mean, this is a good example of why people love bombing.
Oh.
It's right. And so if you were a baby and you didn't get bathed in those neurochemicals and you didn't receive that, when you start to receive that as an adult, your brain is like, wow, I'm getting something I didn't need. Mm-hmm. Right. And so it becomes appealing. But as you do the work in that relationship or later in life, you start to realize, I don't mm-hmm. need to be love bombed. I don't need to be romanced to that level anymore. That actually is intoxicating, or it's not alluring. It becomes less mm-hmm. alluring as you mm-hmm. heal. So the main point is heal, heal, heal. And what does that mean? Bring your sensational experience to someone who can hold it, who's non-judgmental, who can help you integrate this trauma so you're less likely to attract it back mm-hmm. in your life.
Absolutely. Something that I wanted to talk about as well is chemistry versus attachment style, which I feel is quite poignant right now. But obviously, we can be attracted to somebody in this initial moment, right? And we think, like you say, like maybe they're love bombing us, or they seem perfect on paper, or we kind of, maybe we even ignore the red flags because we want it to be perfect. I'm really curious to know in that situation, like, are people tending to go towards someone who's maybe what's, I guess the word would be, slightly unavailable, or because of something that's maybe not healed before, or is it just a chemistry, or do we ignore the attachment style? I'm just really curious.
There's a very good chance. Well, so there's some quantum physics involved. There's an energetic signature that we have. There's trauma that we have in our subconscious. And that's kind of what I talk about healing in the book. And there's many reasons in which why we attract the people mm-hmm. that we do. And so it's a much more complicated layer, and there's no wrong or right. It just is. And so we attract people, and hopefully the wounding comes up and there's mutual healing that can happen in that relationship. And so I don't want to say, oh, chemistry is bad and chemistry is good. I think you need to look past the chemistry and start to understand, does this person have insight around their past? Do they have the same value systems as you do? Like, what are their relationships like in their home? Because remember, you were marrying someone's mm-hmm. family mm-hmm. too. So those dynamics are there. And yeah, I mean, like, who doesn't love the romance, right? But there's no wrong or right. Even if you get love bombed and you're in that relationship, you can use that relationship as a flashlight into what you didn't receive mm-hmm. and as a point of growth for you. So I think you have to kind of meet yourself where you're at. And the whole point is just to be developing the inner awareness of what's going on and what's being activated inside of you as you move through your dating life or your relational life and start to get really conscious no matter where you're at in that process.
It's super interesting. And I mean, this is the ultimate question, I think, but like, how do you honestly really know if somebody is right for you?
I don't actually think there's no right or wrong. There's right yeah. now. And what is this teaching me? And is this person capable of evolving and growing with me?
I love that.
And that's the big piece, because you could meet someone at any stage, but some people aren't willing. And it's not even not willing. Some people aren't capable mm-hmm. of evolving because it's too scary for them to go inward. It's too scary for them to do the work. So you can always meet someone, and if it's two committed, willing people who have the resilience and don't have the fear around doing the inner work, you can mm-hmm. evolve at any point. And I think the question is, did I pick a partner who has what it takes to evolve with me? And sometimes you don't mm-hmm. know that right in the beginning, because when the work shows up, you know, people tend to bolt. And so that's really what you want to look mm-hmm. for. We pick people for a reason.
Absolutely.
And to discount a failed relationship as a failed relationship, then you're missing the work that could have been healing for you in that relationship, and you're kind of labeling it and discounting the value altogether. So every relationship kind of can teach you something about you, and in that way they can be successes. Mm. Into, I know everybody wants this long-term partnership, but you have to get to a place where you will meet someone who has the sustainability and the willingness to evolve with you. And that's not always so easy. And some of that is spiritual, you know, like we don't have control over every factor in our lives. I've seen couples go through hardships that broke them, and they had all the resilient skills and everything, and it still wasn't enough. So there's just no certainty in all of that, even though I know we all want certainty in all
that's
of that.
It definitely, to feel secure. I'd be interested to know as well, so if you're on this journey and you're healing together, I feel like codependency gets a really bad name, but do you then develop this almost codependent way of living together so that essentially you're healing each other as you're going along, but does it make you become more insular and not really start to see maybe slight changes?
I think codependency is an awful word, because what I think you need to know is if your relationship is governed by fear, then there's too much quote unquote codependency. Yeah. And so you really need to unpack that with a couples counselor. But we are made to be interdependent. Yeah. And that's where our culture has a lot wrong. We are supposed to depend on our partner. We need people. And it's like, to what degree mm-hmm. and what capacity can we do this? And how can we also learn that we can't, and it's hard for anxious people, not get all your needs met in one person, because if you partner with someone who's avoidant, your fear is up, and then you want to circle in around feeling secure with that one person, and you're less likely to spread your dependency mm-hmm. out. But we're made to be dependent on so many people in our lives. And that healthy interdependency is what creates community mm-hmm. and a sense of belonging and security. And so if you're single and you can develop really intimate, wonderful friendships and connections, and your nervous system can start to recognize this person's there for me and I can get close to this person, et cetera, et cetera. Your nervous systems can build security that way. And that way, when you meet someone, they're just integrating into your already very secure life. They don't become your whole life. And even that's tricky because in the beginning, it's normal to lose yourself a little. But if you have that secure sense of self, you integrate back and that person integrates into your world and you integrate into their world. And it's kind of this ebb and flow. So I think I went off on a tangent, but there are healthy ways in which we depend on each other that are seen as codependent. And those are very different from living in fear and having that type of adaptive strategies in your relationship.
Yeah, definitely. I see it as it can be only a good thing if it's from a healthy perspective. So absolutely. I love being in partnership with people, friends, family, partner, whatever that might be. I'm really curious as well to know, how do we start to become more consciously aware? Because quite a lot of us like to brush things under the carpet or blame the other person or no, I'm great. It must be you. But actually, there's so much work we all need to do. And that's the really hard bit, isn't it? Getting started. So I guess if you have any maybe steps of being able to be, almost be comfortable with sitting with yourself and actually becoming consciously aware of these things that maybe you need to begin to look at in yourself.
God, you asked like really great questions throughout this whole interview. I mean, so obviously we all want to be conscious, right? And I could sit here today and tell you I'm consciously aware and there's still so much in my subconscious and that we're not. And I think having this problem recently with somebody that I care about deeply, that like you literally can't make another person conscious. You just can't. But if you have the willingness and you're listening and you have these sensational experiences going on in your body, and you have a core wound around I'm being left or I'm unlovable, or, and you know when you have developmental shame around, it feels a certain way inside of you, those things are going to get played out in your relationship. And so 20% of what's happening in your relationship that is causing you distress, dysregulation, being awakened, is connecting to an 80%. And so if you can get out of projecting, which is basically saying my partner is doing this and your partner is doing this, and then it's bringing up this in you. Have you felt it before? Mm-hmm. Can you link it back to an original wound? And if so, your partner is bringing up your work. And so you can change your partner, you can make requests, but essentially that's not going to heal what the original wound is. So if you can start to shift to, my partner has this behavior that really bothers me, and by all means, lots of behaviors are not okay, but the bothering of that behavior probably has more to it than what it was happening in the here and now. So if you can, you know, kind of be a little bit more self-reflective, oh, when they shut down, it probably reminds me of a parent that shut down or a parent that was unavailable. And this is living in my gut and it feels awful. And so now we know that your partner is bringing up your work. And so partners' jobs are to try and become more conscious. It's not their job to heal you. It's their job to be more gracious and more conscious and more understanding. And it's our job to understand what is ours and what is the relational responsibility. And that's a pretty complicated thing when you're in it to really see. And sometimes we need help around.
Definitely. That's honestly, I could like genuinely talk to you for hours. It's so fascinating. I guess if somebody is really new on this journey, you know, we're quite comfortable with going to therapy and like having these conversations, but for some people, it's something they've literally never done. What would you say would be like a really good place to start?
Well, I would say my book, and there are probably some other books out there and podcasts and like things that are actually really talking about this stuff. In compassionate ways. Yeah. I think that from what I've seen out there, avoidant people get villainized and they're in suffering and so much pain too. And so I really worked hard on creating, kind of explaining both sides. And, you know, a therapist, but really also, someone who can just hold space for you. I talk about healing in a non-judgmental, warm way without trying to fix you. We live in a culture where we're always trying to fix, change this, do that. It's this person's fault. Let me pour more gasoline on it. But someone could be like, oh, that must be really hard for you, right? Hold your younger parts and just help regulate your nervous system and someone who has some education and experience around this that you can are able to ask questions and feel safe enough to ask these questions with them. And there are some resources out there and there are some groups out there and there are ways to get there, but you just want to make sure you're asking, if you're going to ask the question, you want to make sure you're asking someone who has a very compassionate lens. And I study neuro, like interpersonal neurobiology, and that seems to really compassionate because you really start to understand why people behave the way they do and how their behaviors make sense. Even the behaviors we can't stand and we disapprove of, they actually all make sense in terms of how people develop.
It's really important. I can't thank you enough, honestly. This conversation is just amazing. We always like to end the podcast with one mindset hack or tip or something that you have that's maybe helped you on your journey that you do, that's almost like a non-negotiable for you.
Mindset, like explain that.
As in, some people, for them, it's making sure they go for their daily walk. Others, it's therapy. It's reading every day. It's having a conversation with yourself. Yeah.
Okay, got it. Well, I do this amazing 45-minute imagination practice in the morning. So excited! I'm taking this course. I take my dog on a walk every morning. Actually, I had to go short this morning, so he was like kind of frustrated with me. And I live by a mantra, and I could unpack this, is that most everybody is doing the best they can with what they have. And that's the truth. If we could do better, we would. We're limited in healing and understanding sometimes, and we all get very stuck. So I try to imagine the person driving down the road giving me the middle finger probably has a well of crying and healing to do underneath that rage. And so I try to just see the world more and more through the compassionate lens that most people are in survival mode. And that makes me have more compassion and understanding that if they could shift out of survival mode and into healing, they wouldn't be raging, right? And so people are doing the best they can, literally.
I love that so much. Thank you so much. Where can everybody find you?
Yeah, so my Instagram is Jessica Baum, LMHC. And my company name is beselfful.com. That's selfful.com. And I have online courses and I have a team of experts that work with me on attachment theory. And yeah, I'm all over the place. And you can just Google me and the book is everywhere. And I love the book. I mean, it's doing so well in the world. And it's a really great place to start. So if you're listening, yeah, and you're curious, that would be a very affordable place to get, just crack the door open on a lot of these comments.
Definitely. I'll leave everything in the show notes, of course. And actually, I recommend getting I got it on Audible, your book, and you obviously talk, and your voice is so soothing. I take you on my dog walk, so I highly recommend.
Oh my God, that was actually so hard for me.
I can imagine.
And I get so many nice comments. I feel like that was hard.
Yeah.
That was really hard. And I'm really, really proud of myself for doing it. But that was not
easy. I can imagine. I can, because you're confronted with yourself completely, aren't you? And just putting everything out there. Oh, no. I know. It's scary.
Yeah. And also, like, when you're reading, you don't know when to take a breath. And, like, there's a lot of, like, cadence issues that you don't think of because you read in your head. And sometimes you read out loud. But when you're reading on that level, you're like, it's just hard. I don't know. But I'm so glad that it came out compassionate in my tone.
It's amazing.
And all of that,
it's amazing. It really spoke to me. So thank you so much for everything. And thank you again for today and all the work that you do.
Thank you for having me.
Oh my goodness. I am sure you love that episode just as much as me. I learned so much while interviewing her. I actually felt almost deep in the conversation and had to almost pull myself back, look above and kind of think, you're interviewing somebody, make sure you don't get completely sucked in and make this episode all about you. And I really, really hope you enjoyed it. It's fascinating to me learning all about the attachment styles and the way that they can really affect us and show up in everyday life. I really hope a part of this episode resonated with you. And if it did, please do share this on your stories, leave a little comment below. Just let me know what felt good for you, or maybe something came up for you that you actually realized you need to work on, because I'm there with you, sister. I am there with you. So you know what part of the podcast it is. It's time to get really comfortable, really cozy as we go into this week's mini meditation.
And I want you to take a moment to just arrive today, to allow yourself to be here, to take a moment to relax, and just thank yourself for being here right now and for being present. You are all you need to focus on. Nobody else needs to take your energy. Nobody else needs to take your focus. It is just you right now. Drawing in a nice deep breath. Really relaxing. And arriving here and being present. And acknowledging where the breath is moving within the body and how the breath feels within the body. Feeling the wave of motion up and down. All the way up and all the way down the body. Breathing deeply. Breathing slowly. And I want you to bring one hand onto the heart center, allowing your other hand to fall, maybe onto your knee or laying next to you, palms facing upwards. And I want you to find comfort of just being in this moment, allowing yourself to receive a new type of energy. Maybe you've been feeling slightly overwhelmed. Maybe you've been feeling anxiously attached right now. Allowing yourself to be present, to breathe, to be here. Breathing gently. Breathing slowly. And asking yourself where else you need to be right now. Allowing yourself to be here, to be present. To take this time and take this moment. Slow breath, slow down. Your hand on your heart center. Feeling your breath. Staying exactly where you are right now. Breathing slowly. Feeling the rise and the fall of the breath. And just gently beginning to notice every movement within the body. And noticing how calm the mind begins to feel. There is no rush. There is nowhere else that you should be but the present. Whenever you feel yourself fall from here, move from here, know that this is there for you. Coming back to your practice as much as you need. Breathing deeply and gently opening your eyes. Thank you so much. I'll see you again next week.